listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Shame the devil. For Mia Farrow and for me, the truth has come with consequences, by Joyce Maynard. Opening photo by Mary Ellen Mark. Joyce Maynard at home in San Francisco in 1999, the year after she published At Home in the World. What do Woody Allen and J.D. Salinger have in common? Start with this. The world knows them as iconic artists whose work transformed the cultural landscape of America. I see them both as predatory men with a taste for teenagers. Both possess the outlook of aging cynics who idealize and seek out innocence and, having done so, destroy it. Here comes another disturbing similarity. In the case of each of these celebrated men, when a woman has dared to shine a light on their dark side and disturbing behavior, in Allen's case, possibly criminal behavior, which he continues to deny, their supporters close ranks. Often with stunning success, they deflect allegations made against the object of their devotion and turn on the person responsible for delivering them. That person would be a woman. I know the part about Allen and very young women only from what I've read over the years. Though watching his films with knowledge of his personal sexual and romantic history, a viewer may register a creepy shiver of recognition. It's all on the screen. The part about Salinger and young girls, also visible in the work if you look, is one with which I am more intimately acquainted. It's a story I've told before. I tell it again because what I experienced long ago still happens, and because in the last handful of months we've borne witness to a whole new round of stories sharing the same familiar theme. The phenomenon of demonizing the women and girls who dare to speak the truth about their lives. When I was a freshman at Yale, a few months past my 18th birthday, Salinger wrote me a series of letters that led me to believe he loved me as no one else ever had. Having read an essay I'd published, accompanied by a picture of a waif like me in blue jeans, I weighed in at 90 pounds and expounded on my virginity, among other topics. He told me I was brilliant and perfect, his soulmate, and that we would live our days out together. He was 53. By 1972, a couple of generations of readers had fallen in love with the voice of Holden Caulfield. So did I, though the way I fell in love with the man came from the letters he wrote to me alone, or so I supposed. I named two events that caused the greatest emotional damage in my life. I'm not speaking here of personal losses, the deaths of my parents, the death of my husband. I'm speaking of times when I felt unsafe, diminished, and under attack, almost to the point of questioning the worth of my own life. One happened when I was a teenager with Salinger, an experience that ended my college education, isolated me from my family, my friends, and the world, and left me in a state of profound shame that endured for decades. The second, and arguably the more painful one, occurred 25 years later, when I chose at long last to speak of what had happened to me when I was young. It took me that long to recognize the truth, that I was groomed to be the sexual partner of a narcissist who nearly derailed my life. When I published a memoir, I was accused of trying to make money from my brief and inconsequential connection to a great man. Adjectives applied to me by well-respected critics included the words icky, masturbatory in Mirabella, indescribably stupid in the Washington Post, and from Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, Predator. Cynthia Ozick condemned me as a person who had attached myself to Salinger to suck out his celebrity. In the eyes of many, I was a literary vampire. For some, simply a cunt. No question, my personal history informed my experience of watching the recent HBO documentary, Allen vs. Farrow. Call the event triggering, and you won't miss the mark. So much of the language once directed at me is nearly identical to what I hear now employed by those who rush to discredit Mia Farrow. The story in Allen vs. Farrow is haunting on two levels. First, for Dylan Farrow's consistent and credible account that Allen did in fact touch her privates when she was 7, as she has always alleged. Equally horrifying is what Allen and his team of high-priced lawyers, publicists, image controllers, and celebrity friends chose to do about the allegations against him. They successfully recast the narrative into the story of an aging, vengeful, and deeply troubled ex-lover who manufactured the story of abuse and coached her child to deliver it. Via his own press conference at the Plaza Hotel, now widely repeated, Allen became the victim of retribution for having rejected Mia for her daughter, Soon Yi, a much younger woman. His crime comes straight out of a romantic movie, Falling in Love. When I wrote about Allen vs. Farrow on Facebook recently, over 1,000 readers weighed in. The vast majority, those who'd actually watched the series, shared my outrage. Almost to a person, those who continue to subscribe to Allen's story said they felt no need to watch the documentary. Allen himself had already explained it to them. What chilled me most was the level of something close to violence, an almost toxic rage, in the way many Allen loyalists spoke about Farrow. "I'd like to smash her face in," wrote one. Some of them weighing in on the documentary, and more on the Woody Allen fan page, chose to quote the old saw, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." The scariest brand of fury I have ever witnessed is that of men confronted by a woman's story of abuse at the hands of a man they idolize. Consider Diane Sawyer in a 2003 interview for Primetime, recently brought to light in the new documentary Framing Britney Spears. Sawyer leans forward in her chair, cool, self-assured, trustworthy, lasering in on the 21-year-old pop star who looks exhausted. "You broke his heart," Sawyer intones, speaking of accusations she'd cheated on Justin Timberlake. "You did something that cost him so much pain. What did you do?" What did you do? The assumption, unquestioned, it's the woman's fault. Sometimes the shamed and hated women remain faceless. Sometimes we know them well. One theme runs through all of these stories, from Meghan Markle to Monica Lewinsky to Andrea Constand. It's not simply about how our culture continues to shame, dismiss, humiliate, devalue, and demonize women. It's the injury, sometimes overt counterattack, often gaslighting, that an abused woman is virtually certain to endure when she breaks her silence to tell what happened to her. Call it a 1-2 punch. The attacks I experienced when I published At Home in the World did not simply seek to invalidate a piece of work of which I felt deeply proud. They did not simply decimate my career for a long time, the same thing that happened to Mia Farrow after she leveled her charges against Allen. At the age of 44, I found my identity effectively reduced to that of a woman about whom only one pertinent fact remained. When I was very young, I had slept with a famous man. When I was no longer young, I told about it. vagina dentata, big mouth. In pre-hashtag Me Too 1998, when I published the book that told the story of what happened between Salinger and me, I might as well have murdered Holden Caulfield. Many have never forgiven me. I got on with my life, wrote many more books, but not without great cost. For a lover of Woody Allen movies, confronted with the HBO documentary, it is as if Dylan Farrow ran into the theater and threw a bucket of paint on the screen. As for Mia Farrow, she speaks about her fears once the documentary has aired. There would be a new round of attacks. It will never end. It has never truly ended for me either. The year following the publication of my memoir, I made the decision to sell the 14 letters Salinger had written to me when I was 18. I had no use for these, so I consigned them to Sotheby's. The letters were put on display for potential buyers. They remained available for examination by collectors, literary historians, biographers, devotees of an important writer. The letters offered much about the author's views on a wide range of topics: baseball, jazz, Buddhism, Hitchcock movies, gardening, his children, writing. I was told by someone who worked at Sotheby's that not a single serious critic or literary historian, biographer, or member of the press paid a visit to the auction house. But on the subject of me and my money-grubbing choice to sell what were described as my love letters, the press was relentless. Had I no shame? Actually, no. I saw no crime in divesting myself of letters that served only as reminders of a hurtful and damaging time. As it turned out, these letters, whose buyer said he would return them to Salinger, were somewhat less rare than I had supposed. Over the years, I heard from over a dozen women who had similar sets of letters from Salinger, written to them when they were teenagers. It appeared that in the case of one girl, Salinger was writing to her while I sat in the next room, believing he was my soulmate and partner for life. Among those angry Facebook messages, there was one citing yet again the story of how I sold my love letters. Hearing that a 53-year-old man wrote letters to an 18-year-old college freshman, some still condemn me, rather than considering the motives of the man who wrote them in the first place. Consider the irony of suggesting it's the woman's fault for sharing her story, not the fault of the man for having made the story happen. Call this person out, and he may invoke cancel culture. Flip the narrative, make the perpetrator the victim. Then the inevitable question: Sawyer was hardly the last to have raised it. What did you do? My answer: I'm a woman. I told the truth.
Thank you.
Here's this month's cover story, Ray of Light, by Johanna Desta. Photographs by Adrian Raquel, styled by Shayona Torini. After 5 celebrated seasons, Insecure is wrapping up on HBO, but creator and star Issa Rae, the patron saint of L.A., has a slew of game-changing plans. Opening photo, a regal Issa Rae, photographed March 28th in Beverly Hills. Issa Rae doesn't make vision boards anymore, but let's take a look at her last one and see how she did. She assembled it from magazine photos, headlines, and other odds and ends at the behest of her publicist back in 2013 when she was between projects. It's now framed on a wall in her makeshift home office in Los Angeles. Among other things, Rae, who was born Joissa Rae Diop, wanted to cook healthier meals, to fall in love, to have a house with a pool. The board, I can't help but notice when she zooms me around the room, also has an HBO logo on it and the words TV writer. You could say the thing worked. Rae has indeed fallen in love. She has an enormous diamond engagement ring, about which she deadpans, "I'm fully single." And as for her TV career, the world has increasingly fallen in love with her. When it debuted on HBO in 2016, Rae's show Insecure was the first comedy in the network's history of more than 4 decades to be created by and star a black woman. It was an instant hit, praised by critics for its energizing humor, its complex depiction of dating, and its adoring view of Los Angeles. Insecure is to Inglewood and Crenshaw what Sex and the City was to Manhattan. The show hinges on Rae, not just as an executive, she co-created it with Larry Wilmore and still writes and produces, but also as a nuanced, deeply relatable comic actor. As Issa Dee, she is an every woman with a Hollywood sheen, a glowed-up, doe-eyed version of you and your friends. Rae recently signed an overall production deal with HBO's parent company, Warner Media, said to be worth $40 million. She now has so many ventures in the works that she bought a building 7 minutes from her home to serve as her headquarters. With Insecure set to end after its 5th season this year, Rae's future is a little more open, a little less defined by the demands of a TV production. She's 36 and has nailed a lifetime's worth of vision board visions in less than a decade. I've witnessed this ascent, having interviewed Rae several times in her career. In 2016, before Insecure began, later that year after Rae was nominated for a Golden Globe. In 2017, after she was snubbed for an Emmy, and last year in the midst of the pandemic. Her personality, somewhat remarkably, is the same as it ever was. Funny, friendly, and quick, with a dollop of ER-esque self-deprecation. I compliment her for achieving so much. She insists she hasn't done anything at all. "I have 1 web series, 1 show," she says. "I haven't even written a movie. Of the shit that's mine, I don't have much." When I talk to Rae this time around, she and her team are in the throes of shooting the final season of Insecure, and she's determined not to squander the goodwill and devotion of the audience, which grew exponentially during quarantine last year. "I'm finding myself putting season 1 pressure back on the show again," she tells me. She's even been rewatching Insecure from the beginning, which has been a complicated experience. "All these memories come up, so I can't watch it purely objectively. And then, of course, you look at performance stuff. You look at hair stuff. You look at appearance stuff. You're just like, okay, wow, I went on TV like that?" Details are everything on Insecure. Originally, the show seemed like a glossier version of The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, the gleefully misanthropic web series that helped Rae get Hollywood's attention. Insecure follows Issa Dee, an aimless 29-year-old, and her best friend Molly, a polished lawyer. Issa, the character, is goofy and endearing. She's working a dead-end job at a dubious nonprofit called We Got Y'all. The company's logo is a white hand holding the silhouettes of three black children, and is initially stuck in a relationship with a jobless couch fixture named Lawrence J. Ellis. The first season was funny and sexy, but grounded. Issa kicks back in her room, hangs out with her friends, and blows off steam by performing nerdy raps and aggressive duologues to her own reflection, a character lovingly dubbed Mirror Bitch. As the show grew, HBO became increasingly excited, upping budgets and scheduling it after Game of Thrones and Ballers, which yielded a huge ratings boost and a spot in the network's lineup of must-see TV. Ending the show after five seasons was always Ray's intention. "I pretty much go with my gut, and this is what my gut's been telling me forever," she says, between sips of Jack Daniel's honey whiskey with bitters. COVID has naturally made production harder. Extras for crowd scenes have to be quarantined together in a hotel. Episodes have to be shot out of order, and work hours have to be trimmed. Production also had to be shut down for 2 weeks after a background actor tested positive. Ray happened to be the person closest to them and had to quarantine. "On a Wednesday morning in March, Ray invites me to sit in on a virtual production meeting with her and 72 crew members, during which they inch through the logistics of shooting the third episode of season 5. First assistant director Toby Burge reads through the script, pausing for notes and brainstorms. In the episode, Issa's once and possibly future boyfriend, Lawrence, has to cook a meal. It will probably last all of 4 seconds on screen. Still, it sparks a debate. What should Lawrence be cooking? What will it connote about his skill level? What will it say about his status in life, since he's transformed over the seasons into a hyper-successful tech bro? Lasagna, Ray says. Someone else suggests ramen. Showrunner Prentice Penny jokingly pitches lobster thermidor, and so on. Ultimately, director Ava Berkowski, who wears huge glasses like Sophia from The Golden Girls and radiates a tranquil energy, renders her verdict. "Lasagna's complicated," she says. "That'll look good." During the meeting, Ray is by turns attentive and dreamy, surreptitiously texting her co-workers, then trying to hide her smile when their responses make her laugh. She interrupts only occasionally, like when it suggested that Lawrence pay for dinner at a restaurant by pulling out his money clip. "He has a money clip?" Ray says. "Have we established that before? That's what men do. What is he, a pimp? Y'all have money clips?" Penny unmutes to back her up. "He should not have a money clip, just a wallet. He should just have a wallet." They move on to the next scene. Ray seems like a surprisingly hands-off leader, not a micromanager, but a team player on a team she built and trust. Yvonne Orhai, who plays Issa's bougie best friend, confirms this for me, noting that Ray took a chance on Penny, Melina Matsoukas, Orhai herself, and many others. "We were all first-timers in so many different ways," she says. "I was a comedian, but this was my first major acting job. Prentice had been a writer, but this was his first showrunning gig. Melina had been doing music videos, but this was her first TV directing gig. Issa had to believe that we could do it, and she trusted her baby with us. I wish that more people in power could have the same attitude. She literally puts people in positions and allows them to do their jobs. She lets people grow." During one of our Zoom interviews, Ray gets a text from co-star Natasha Rothwell, who's directing an episode even as we speak. "Yvonne says she's killing it," Ray says proudly. But lest I believe all the stuff about her being a beloved, beneficent leader, Ray assures me that she's actually been driving her writers up the wall lately, particularly with her Insecure rewatch. "We'd be working on story, and I'd be like, But I watched season 3, episode 2 last night, and they're like, ugh, what's she got to say now? What are you about to change now? What are you about to bring up? At the time of the interview, the series finale has yet to be written, and Ray wants to make sure they're following through on her original vision. Recently, she sent a long, passionate letter to Penny and executive producer and writer Amy Iniobe that began, okay, come up with an idea I'm really excited about that consolidates some of the ideas that have been brewing for us. I was thinking of my own life and some of my long-term and long-distance friendships, and thinking of the reasons to gather our girls that feel central to our show. Ray says the last 3 episodes of the series should feel like a cohesive triptych, and the fact that the episodes are being filmed out of order this year makes it even harder for her to track the season's arcs as she watches incoming cuts. I don't know if it's because it's not complete, but I'm like, is this, she comically grits her teeth and lowers her voice, not good? I take all this to be a healthy, or at least semi-healthy, sign of creative ambition. But when I ask Ray if she'll star in her own shows in the future, she says something that surprises me, and I realize there's another reason she's putting pressure on herself. Girl, no, I'm never doing this again, she says. Before you ask that question, I told myself I would never write and be in a show that I created again. It takes up a lot of your life, and I like to do a lot of things. Ray slows her cadence, choosing her words carefully. I love doing this show. I'm so grateful to be able to do this show, but that's just not really for me. The next time Ray and I talk, she's wearing a giant pink Farm Rio cardigan over a white tank top and super fleece sweatpants. She's just received her first COVID vaccination, which she got at the Crenshaw Mall with a group of friends. That shit has wiped me out, she says. I'm talking about chills, body aches. It's not great, but yay, it means my immune system is good. Even sick, she woke up at 4 a.m., as she does every morning, to go for a walk and attend to business in the quiet hours. Ray also clears her mind by writing in her journal at least 3 times a week. She tried therapy in the past, but is holding off until she can safely meet someone in person after the pandemic. I guess work has been my outlet, which is sad, she says. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't have anybody to talk to who understands. But I also never want to be in a position to offer up my problems to somebody. After her journal, the closest thing Ray has to therapy is astrology, though she insists that she's not hyper-woo-woo about it. She's astrological in the sense that she checks out the app The Pattern for her horoscope from time to time and is fully aware of her Capricorn traits. Also, when I inform her that I'm a Scorpio, she has a question locked and loaded. Do people tell you that you're crazy? Answer, not to my face. I ask Ray to read me her daily horoscope. She pushes her rolling chair away from her desk to grab her phone across the room. This shocks me a little, frankly, because everyone I know needs to maintain skin-to-skin contact with their phones at all times, and opens the app. After a moment, she laughs to herself, and a hint of embarrassment creeps up her throat. Well, now it's going to seem arrogant, she says. It just says, natural networker. You know how to put others at ease. In social situations, you're intuitively aware of what people are thinking and do what's appropriate in response. Well, it's true, I tell her. I'm at ease in this social situation. Ray lets loose with a big laugh. Anyway, it's not a bad reading for someone who built her career out of being comically uncomfortable in her own skin, literally stamping her brand with the words awkward and insecure. She attributes all this partly to her family. We all think about the same uncomfortable situations and have very similar observations, she says. You could replace me with any of my siblings, an awkward black girl, and you would still get the same humor. Ray comes from a big, extremely close family. Ask who the biggest insecure fan in the bunch is, she's hard-pressed to choose, Maybe my sister. I don't really know. Maybe my oldest brother on the low. Ray was born in Los Angeles to an African-American teacher, Del May. She was born in Los Angeles to an African-American teacher, Delina, and a Senegalese pediatrician, Abdoulaye Diop. She has four siblings, Lamine, Amadou, Malik, and Elise. One of Ray's first web series, a mockumentary called Fly Guys Present the F Word, was inspired by Lamine's rap group and starred Lamine himself. The family moved around during Ray's childhood, staying for a time in a luxurious home in Dakar, Senegal. In her 2015 memoir, Ray wrote that they had a multi-level house, a security guard, and two maids. Life was great for 2 years, until my father attempted to build a hospital in Senegal and instead got ripped off by the government, losing most of his money in the process. That's when, to my sadness and my older brother's relief, we packed our bags to return to the States. The Diops moved to Potomac, Maryland, then back to L.A., where Ray's father was locally known thanks to the Inglewood Clinic on Manchester Boulevard that bore his name. Her parents divorced when she was in high school. That strained her relationship with her father for several years, though she talks warmly about him now. Ray, who speaks Wolof and French, hasn't been back to Senegal since 2009. It's one of the few topics that makes her noticeably gloomy. "I feel disconnected from it," she says. "I wanted to go back in 2020. That was going to be the year. And then that got derailed. But so much has changed." She pauses, falling silent for a few seconds. Much of her extended family has since left Senegal. "Yeah," she finally says, loading the word to the hilt. "I just know that it wouldn't be the same." She's proud of her Senegalese side, though, and eventually hopefulness warms up her voice. "I would love to have a house there," she says. "I would love to take my future kids there, and maybe give them the same type of childhood and appreciation that my parents gave us." Ray's fiancé, businessman Louis Diam, is Senegalese and Vietnamese. The pair met while Ray was in college, and she said in her memoir that from the very first five-hour conversation, she knew she had met her match. In 2011, Ray made her web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, and carved a lane for herself, as well as for other black girls who were gawky and antisocial, in the key of Tina Fey in 30 Rock, or Larry David in Everything. Both are frequent touch points for Ray. The archetype existed before she gave face to it. Not that the industry's largely white bosses recognized it. Both in interviews and in her memoir, Ray has told the story of a TV executive who suggested that Lauren London, an actor who got her start playing the love interest in a spate of music videos and in films like the drama ATL, would be a great fit for a cable version of Awkward Black Girl. The moral of the story was not only that executives were out of touch with black women, swapping one for another even when they were nothing alike, but also that dark-skinned black women could be edited out of their own narratives. In a twist that Ray didn't anticipate, the anecdote hurt London's feelings. "One of my biggest regrets, naming her," she says. "She took offense to that." The duo made peace at Diddy's birthday party 2 years ago, Ray says, spurred by London's partner, the late Nipsey Hussle. The rapper approached Ray at the party and encouraged her to make things right. He was like, "You should just talk to her. Let me set it up," she says. It actually sparked an amazing two-hour conversation. We had so much in common. She was like, "People don't understand. I'm an awkward black girl." In the same way that I was upset about the limited portrayal of black women, she was like, "People do the same thing to me. I completely get that." The conversation borrowed itself in Ray's brain. With Insecure, she has actively expanded the scope of characters that black women can relate to, and that mission will continue to guide her. Ray is now producing such a variety of things that she's like someone who just came back from a buffet with a towering plate. Next up is Sweet Life, a docuseries in the vein of Laguna Beach and the Hills, about black 20-somethings living in L.A.'s Tony Baldwin Hills neighborhood. The show was inspired by the 2007 BET series Baldwin Hills, which Ray loved. One of the managers at Color Creative, Ray's initiative promoting inclusion in TV, was a former cast member of the series. Alongside Adam McKay, Ray is also producing an adaptation of Nice White Parents, a quietly infuriating podcast about a public school in Brooklyn. She's writing, producing, and starring in Perfect Strangers, based on the Italian dramedy Perfetti Sconosciuti, about a group of friends learning each other's darkest secrets during a chaotic dinner party. And then there's the second season of a black lady sketch show, the Emmy-nominated series that Ray executive produces. Vanity Fair can exclusively report that Ray is also working on a revival of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's HBO docuseries Project Greenlight, which gave money and support to aspiring filmmakers. The series is known less for the films it produced than for a scene in its final season, in which Damon pushed back against producer Effie Brown for saying that the casting for the participants in the series should have been more inclusive. When we're talking about diversity, you do it in the casting of the film, not in the casting of the show, he insisted. Wow, Brown responded, visibly stunned. The scene sparked a backlash and prompted Damon to issue a public apology. Project Greenlight was canceled in 2016. Ray's excitement lies predominantly in offering overlooked directors a place to shine. I want this version of the show to make filmmaking feel attainable. Those who love Ray's on-screen presence will be relieved to hear that she's also lining up more film and TV roles. She's eager to polish her acting chops, inspired by collaborators like Lakeith Stanfield, who starred with her in 2020's The Photograph. Ray remembers Stanfield telling her that he was still shaking off a character he'd recently played in another film. He was like, you know how you just black out when you're playing a role? And I was like, ah, yeah. She was only pretending she could relate, she tells me now. I've never had that opportunity. I just want to be able to see what I can do. Years ago, Twitter became obsessed with a photo of Rihanna and Lupita Nyong'o sitting side by side at a Miu Miu fashion show, the former in espionage-grade shades and a furry yellow and black coat, the latter in a crisp-collared shirt and thick glasses. Users called for Ava DuVernay to direct a film based on the shot, with a script by Ray. In 2017, Netflix went ahead and actually secured a deal for the concept, though Ray artfully dodged any confirmation of the news when I interviewed her later that year. She did, however, concede that the four of them had connected and were on a text chain together. 4 years later, it seems less and less likely that the movie will ever be made, though Ray still gets questions about it. Every year without fail, she says, when I bring it up again, zero comment, nothing has changed. As if to taunt me some more, Ray tells me there is some kind of secret movie with someone in the works, but she can't talk about it in case it doesn't materialize. Otherwise, I'll just be really sad, like, damn, I guess it's not happening, and I talked about that shit. And I'll blame you, she adds. I will. She raises her brow and keeps a straight face. Then she busts out laughing. I sit in on one more conference with the Insecure team before my time with Ray is over. It's known as the Tone Meeting, and it's less about logistics and more about the feeling of an episode and whether it's hitting the proper emotional beats. It follows directly after the production meeting, the number of participants dwindling from 73 to 18. Ray can be more animated here, more honest. The group discusses the various tension points that occur in the episode, including how ugly an argument between two characters should be. Aniobe, the writer and producer, says that she thinks it should have the energy of F.U., but saying F.U. is too far. They discuss the deep fan hatred for Lawrence's ex, Condola, and whether they can give her a redemptive scene that won't feel like they're simply pandering to their audience. They discuss one character going on a series of dates and how he should start with a girl who doesn't feel too far out of his league. A layup, Penny says. Ray gives him a disapproving look, but he continues, "Don't women go on dates for food? I'm about to take this N-word to get me a meal. Don't women do that?" "I've never done that in my life," Ray retorts, sounding very much like she has done that in her life. The room devolves into sidebar nation, everyone debating Penny's point. "I don't know," Ray says finally, trying to end the tangent. "That was the most grandma answer," says Penny, mimicking her with a creaky voice. "I don't know." The meeting gets reflective at times, which is to be expected when a show is winding down long-running plots. The group talks about tertiary characters in an upcoming episode and how they don't want to repeat mistakes from a past season, in which two side characters felt too much like caricatures for Ray's liking. "What were we doing?" Ray says with a resigned laugh. "That wasn't our greatest moment." Everyone agrees until writer-producer Laura Kittrell interrupts. "We did great," she says confidently, which causes everyone to dissolve into laughter. "It's the last season. Let's celebrate ourselves. What are we doing?" "I'm sorry, you're right," Ray says. She shakes her head and smiles broadly. "Progression. Growth." Hearing all this, I remember Yvonne Orhide telling me about a conversation she had last fall with her co-star Jay Ellis. I was like, "Hey fam, what do we do after this?" You know, when you work with people you like and you genuinely enjoy it, and there's no beef, and you're doing good work. I imagine it was like that after the Obamas left the White House. If you were a staffer, do you just retire? Because, like, who you gonna work for better than Barack and Michelle? Like, who? Does this exist anywhere else? We had such a beautiful moment that probably can't be replicated. Fortunately for them and us, the show's not over yet. During the tone meeting, Jonathan Barry, who's an executive producer, asked what Ray and Kittrell were laughing about in the production meeting, since it was obvious that they were messaging each other constantly. "It's got to be about me, right?" he says. "I'm sitting here going, maybe it's about me," adds Aniobe. Ray shakes her head fondly. "Wow," she says, "insecure much?" Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Norman Lear, the prolific television producer, looks back on happy times in Italy and forward to his 100th year. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Waking up in the morning is as perfect as anything gets. What is your greatest fear? The greatest fear I can remember is coming back from World War II and being amazed that I was more afraid to audition for a job than I was flying 52 missions. On what occasion do you lie every time I relay my weight? What do you dislike most about your appearance, the part that makes me look my age? Which living person do you most despise, the person who most admires Donald Trump? What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? The rare moment I don't believe in myself enough. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Dishonesty and insincerity. What is your greatest extravagance? I may be a little more extravagant than I should be in my affections. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Hi. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? A good personality with little behind it. Who are your heroes in real life? Ben Bradley and Muhammad Ali. What is your greatest regret? That I can't age downward for the next 20 years. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My wife, 6 children, and 4 grandchildren. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I would have them all living closer. When and where were you happiest? I was the happiest every time we landed in Foggia, Italy, after a bombing mission during World War II. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd like to have sung like Pavarotti. Which historical figure do you most identify with? The political journalist I.F. Stone. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Not being true to one's word. How would you like to die? Of record-breaking old age. What is your favorite occupation? Laughing. What is your most marked characteristic? Being true to my word. What do you most value in your friends? The same thing. Who is your favorite writer? Ralph Waldo Emerson. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? As a boy, Frank Merriwell. What is it that you most dislike? Anything and anyone phony. What is your current state of mind? I'm looking forward to my 100th year. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'd like to come back as a boy, to do it all over again. What is your motto? Over and next. When something is over, it is over, and we are on to next. And if there was a hammock in the middle of those two words, that would be the best definition I know of living in the moment. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Norman Lear. We'll be right back. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.